Hello, it's Kitty Martone, Healthy Gut Girl, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know, coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine. And we have a returning guest today, whom I adore, Dr. Salome Mashkati, who I just think is just the sweetest woman, who has so much valuable information to share with us. She is a board-certified gynecologist who specialized for several years in uterus removal and uterus surgery, hysterectomies. And so she has loads of wonderful, amazing information to share with us about what she knows and what she recommends. And she inspired my article in Substack, Hysterectomy Chronicles, which is already live, and you can check that out. Actually, I pre-launched this podcast, the video portion of it, early for those of you who are paid members. So a lot of you have already heard this podcast, and I'm really enjoying Substack because it's giving me that ability to kind of reward my really loyal audience members, and I love that. So yeah, you guys are going to get a lot of extras, including sneak peeks to some of my favorite podcasts, as well as I have a little, surprise coming up. I shouldn't have even said that because I'm not going to tell you what it is, so why should I bring it up? But I will say that Substack is awesome. It's giving me a lot of what I was hoping to get from Mighty Network. A lot of, obviously I'm able to post my articles and also post my podcasts. And the podcast is going to be hosted on the Substack platform from now on. So if you're having some glitches with the podcast, look in the show notes of this podcast and you're going to see a new RSS link feed link. And you can replace your old link with this one, but you shouldn't have to. You should just be able to listen from whatever platform you were listening on before. But if it is glitching out, try this new link that's in the show notes. And if that's still a problem, let me know. I know migration of podcasts to different platforms is meant to be super easy and seamless, but it hasn't been that way so far, which is just par for the course these days, right? I wanted to, before we get to the show, I wanted to talk to you guys about the changes that I've made since doing my battery of tests with Georgie Dinkoff, who I'm sending him some more skin and hair samples now that I've had some really big changes. It's been, I think, over 4 months now that I started T3 and a thyroid glandular. And it is definitely coupled with my new pro-metabolic lifestyle of, you know, lifting weights and, eating or trying to eat enough every day. I'm doing really good with it. And it's showing up. It's showing up in my body. I'm starting to notice I have very, very rare. In fact, I don't even remember the last time I had a histamine reaction of any sort. Candida, haven't had issues in ages. No hot flashes, no menopausal symptoms, feeling strong, sleeping much, much better. But I notice that when I don't eat enough and I'm not consistent with my walking, I definitely, my sleep is affected. And so, you know, eating enough, I said this in the group the other day, we are always encouraging people to have like some sweet potatoes before you go to bed, or some honey with salt, or some orange juice, or a little bit of dairy, or something to carry you through the night so that your blood sugar doesn't drop and you're not woken up by adrenaline at 3 a.m. or whatever. But I'm realizing now, thanks to Constantine and his glucose, how to utilize glucose well. I've read that thing so many times and I've recommended it so many times. And if you have not joined Constantine's Substack, you don't know what you're missing. That will also be in the show notes. But, you know, managing blood sugar does not start before bed, right? It starts from the moment you wake up and how you are eating, the calories you're getting, what are you fueling your vehicle with? You know, what are you giving yourself to carry you through the whole day? And if you're fasting, if you're starting your day off in a deficit, you're probably going to have a tough time catching up by the time you go to bed. That's just the truth of it. And for those of you that love fasting, that is great. And if it's working for you, awesome. But if you're having problems sleeping, if you're having adrenal fatigue, if you are having any kind of hormonal imbalance and you're fasting, you might consider that it might not be ideal. It might be fixing one problem while creating another problem. So I'm just noticing some amazing things with these changes finally. And the eczema that I'm always complaining about on my foot that I've tried to fix with everything is finally, like, actually this has only been about 4 or 5 days that I have no problems with it at all. Anything used to set it off, and it's been pretty cool. So those of you guys who saw my live, that's also something I posted in the Substack. I had a live with Kitty Bloomfield. So it was Kitty and Kitty and her husband, Craig. And we had so much fun, and I really took one for the team, let me tell you, because they really just shone some light on my mistakes and my failures with, you know, with what I'm doing. And so, you know, it's a little humbling, and I'm pretty happy that they did do that, even though I was a little bit awkward for those of you that were watching, especially with Craig, man. He really held me to the fire there, but that's okay. I learned a lot, and I hope you guys did too. But I did mention the eczema thing in that, which was hilarious. Well, what came from the awesome live was also that we decided it might be kind of fun to do a full moon Zoom. So every full moon, we're going to try and have a Zoom call, a live Zoom call, not with Kitty and Craig, but with all of us. So if you want to join us and you're not in the estrogen dominance support group, you should join on Facebook, but it's going to be on Zoom anyway. So I'll probably send it out in a newsletter, the Zoom link. All right. So what else? I think that's it for now. And just, enjoy Dr. Mashkari. She's wonderful. And I will talk to you afterwards.
I mean, I appreciate that you're being candid with me about that stuff going on with you. My experiences with doctors is that they have no idea what I'm going through. They're just like, okay. But like, I would love for them to say to me, yeah, I went through that too. Or my daughter's mm-hmm. going through that. You know, there's something like personable about it that makes you feel like you're not weird.
Yeah. It means a lot that you say that, because it doesn't come naturally to me to be vulnerable with anybody, not just with patients, but it's just, I was so used to always being on my own, fighting, moving to countries by myself. I never like complain. So to me, that's complaining to be vulnerable, but it's mm-hmm. not really. So I'm learning that. So you saying that means a lot, because I think I should share more with patients what I'm going through myself right now.
Yeah. Because, you know, it's like people say, well, you know, you don't want to go to someone who is not well. It's mm-hmm. like, what? That doesn't make any sense. Like, we're humans. We're going to go in and out of being not feeling well, you know, and sometimes I'll be candid and honest with people in the group about what I'm going through. And they're like, well, why should we? No one says this. Some people have, but nobody usually says this, but why should we listen to you about hormones if you're still dealing with, you know, hormonal stuff? And I'm like, well, I'm not a robot, you know, exactly. I'm going to have experiences. Well, that's interesting what you said before we started about the FSH, and that nothing can bring down FSH. Tell me a little bit about what that means.
FSH is what the brain sends to the ovaries to stimulate the cells in the ovaries that produce estradiol in the first half of our cycle. And as the estradiol comes up, that stimulates the brain to release LH, which then stimulates ovulation. Understanding that will women and make them understand why, for example, the progesterone is low. So if you don't build up enough estradiol in the first half of the cycle, then you will never trigger that LH release and you will not have a good ovulation. In addition, if your egg quality is lower, and as we age, our egg quality goes down, we might have stem cells in the ovaries that could mature and become follicles, but overall our egg quality goes down. And so as those eggs change, those cells that get stimulated by the brain, they don't respond as much anymore. So when they don't respond as much to make estradiol, and then they also don't respond as much after ovulation to make progesterone, that's super important. And so how do we check for the quality of these eggs and how much egg reserve we have is actually the FSH. Because if the FSH is yelling at the ovaries, it's trying way too hard to wake something up that just doesn't want to work as hard. So FSH going up means the ovary is just not really keeping up with what the brain wants it to do.
So
And
that
so
messaging should not be high. That
it shouldn't
FSH.
be high. Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
So if you had enough estradiol and if your eggs were in a good quality and you have enough egg reserve, that FSH is going to be below 10 or at the very least below 20. But when you see it shoot up and it's above 20, that's a fantastic marker to look at way before menopause hits you. Because years before that, when you're entering perimenopause and you're feeling a lot the ups and downs more, that's because now the brain and the ovary, their communication is off and the ovary doesn't want to keep up as much. And then the brain has to yell at it. So the FSH is one of those early markers you can check. I'll give you an example for me. I was telling you before we started recording, I just haven't been feeling great. And it's been a few months. I don't feel like doing anything, going out, being social. I thought maybe it had to do with the spiritual warfare with the world, what's going on.
Yeah, all
And
that
I'm
too.
pretty sure it's contributing, but there was something beyond all of that that was outside of my control. Like I would wake up. I wake up and I have the worst joint pain I've never had in my life. I have ankle pain and knee pain, and I don't want to work out. And that's not me. I'm a joyful person. I love connecting with people. I like to be happy. I just don't feel anything. I'm like flatlined. I thought it's my thyroid because a few months back, and I shared that on Instagram, and it was the first time I was ever vulnerable with anybody on social media.
Oh.
I said, I think I have Hashimoto's. My thyroglobulin antibodies were elevated. My TPO antibodies were a little bit elevated. And my thyroid, my T3 was very low. It was below 3. And I was like, oh my God, that will explain everything because that can cause joint pain and fatigue and depressed mood and all of that. And I also had missed my period 1 month. And I thought maybe the thyroid is the cause because as your thyroid stimulates your ovaries as well. So it does have an implication in ovulation. So if you have very low thyroid function, you're going to end up with lower progesterone levels because you're not ovulating regularly. So I was like, I got it all figured out. That's the reason, you know, that's what it is. I corrected my thyroid now. I'm on desiccated thyroid. I titrated myself up to a dose and I rechecked myself periodically. And my last T3 was 3.9, so which is a really good level. And I was like, why am I still feeling crap? Like, what's going on? And I told you, I'm not at the age where I should be undergoing menopause. Anywhere between 45 to 55, you can be like, that's maybe okay range for menopause. On average, usually the median is about 50, 51. My own mother didn't have menopause until the age of 55. So I always thought, oh my God, I'm good. You know, I always wanted the latest age of menopause possible because it's the best you can have. Like, I'm always jealous when I have patients and they're like 57 years old and they're still not in menopause. I'm like, you are a fertility queen and I hope you never undergo menopause. And they look at me, they're like, are you crazy? I want to stop having periods. And I'm like, no, this is the best because it's saving you from cardiovascular disease and bone loss and dementia. And so I was like, there's no way I'm undergoing menopause. And I checked my FSH and my estradiol. So you do that about cycle day 3, meaning if your first day of your period is cycle day 1, you check about 3 to 4 days after having your period. And my FSH was off the charts. It was like 50. I thought like cry. I felt like crying. I just thought this Monday. And it's just not pleasant to me, but it explains what's going on. And I think I'm just not producing enough estradiol. I'm feeling a lot of this. And then I'm obviously not ovulating correctly either. So I'm progesterone deficient, but I was on cyclical progesterone before. So that was covered. But I think I need more. And so I was just talking to you about it's not pleasant, but it's a learning curve for me, and I think it will allow me to understand patients a little bit better even than I did before going through this. I just wish I didn't have to, but I see very often in my practice young women undergoing premature ovarian failure, premature menopause. A lot of it had to do with COVID and the COVID vaccine the last few years, but before that even there were other injuries that can cause the ovaries to prematurely give up. And in my case, I don't think it's genetic, but I think that's because of environmental toxins and a certain vaccination that I told you I got. It was the Gardasil. I believe that probably contributed because there are studies reporting that for women getting Gardasil, premature ovarian failure. And so I think that's what's going on. I don't like it. It's a big deal to me. I was always like, I want to have menopause at 55.
Me too.
So it's really hard for me. I got to be honest on a spiritual level, but at the same time, I'm going to try to make the most out of it. And whatever I learn, I'll share with patients. And I wanted to share that today. And I wanted to say, what's really important, Kitty, is that not everybody's going to have hot flashes or night sweats. I have none of that. But for me, it's this feeling of I'm not depressed. I go to work, I do my things. But I don't want to do anything else. I don't have any resilience for stress. I can't deal with any additional stress, and I don't want to do too much. And almost like my ego is completely gone. I have nothing to prove, which can be positive, but it's like I also don't want to do anything. And so it's the weirdest thing in with my personality. I'm just more like tired. I'm just extremely fatigued. So for me, it's like manifesting itself at that. For other women, they might be more irritable or angry, or for other women, they might just want to cry. But for me, it's just like I just don't want to do anything, and I'm tired all the time. I could sleep 5 hours every afternoon, and it's just weird because my thyroid is definitely good. So.
It's so interesting. I like the you use the words flatlined because I've certainly been there for sure. So tell me what could be the reasons for unhealthy ovaries besides just aging. I know Dr. Rapi is like, well, the more nutrient dense your food is, the more you are boosting your metabolism and you're working out and you're walking and you're doing these things that boost metabolism, your ovaries can be healthy ongoing. So tell us what is most commonly damaging ovary function or ovarian function.
I wish we were looking into that a lot more than we really do. Nobody's that interested in studying it, but from the things that I have seen and some of the medical literature, there can be some genetic predisposition to certain people being experienced. And it often happens that it runs in a family and then it can be associated with some other genetic problems. That's one factor. Then the thyroid being inefficient can actually affect the ovaries, but that would be something that if you correct the thyroid could correct itself because you do have the stem cells of those eggs that can then mature. But overall, what could damage the ovaries, and I think I'm teaching that myself because I'm just doing detailed research, but I think a lot of it is environmental. Because if you think about why do we have a lot more younger women experience that, we have to think about what has changed so much over the last few decades in our environment, and we're definitely more exposed to heavy metals and chemicals, and we know that they can actually store themselves in ovarian tissue. Okay, so yeah, I have cases of some women I had actually sent to a hair tissue mineral analysis expert, and two of them, after doing mineral balancing, got their periods back. Yeah, so that was one way to address that by pushing the heavy metals out. And heavy metals can store themselves in the thyroid, in deep tissue, bones, brain, and ovaries as well. The ovaries are not protected from anything else that attacks us anywhere else. And then other things, the factors can be decreased blood flow. This is why hysterectomy can lead to earlier menopause because you are decreasing the blood flow to the ovaries. So women that have just decreased blood flow, doing, for example, acupuncture or activating the meridians and bringing more blood flow there, or even the grounding machine like the PEMF machine that we have in our clinic that can bring more blood flow to the organs can improve the ovarian function. So increased blood flow, decreased increased toxins, decreased blood flow, and then yeah, anything that causes even stress and shock. There are women who undergo menopause rapidly because they lost a loved one. They lost their husband or a child. And that sorrow and deep sadness causes so much stress that the body completely shuts down what represents their fertility, right? So they can actually undergo menopause. I've had patients like that too. And then I don't like to say it, but I've had women after COVID and COVID vaccination have premature menopause as well. And yeah, so I've seen it all. I think it's just a mixture of toxins, stress, blood flow, and so what, and then nutrients. Now with nutrients, you know I'm the biggest proponent of nutrient balance, right? That's why I love repeats, and I love a lot of the doctors who get it right, that where you balance your basics. And I did my Nutrival. I'm keeping up with it. My B vitamins, my oat looks really good. My magnesium, zinc levels look good. I haven't done hair tissue. I might do that, but just from what I know from blood work, my minerals look really good. I have a high dense, animal protein food diet. I need my macronutrients for protein. I'm really trying to optimize my sleep, my light environment, everything I preach. I did all of that, but I still felt crap. I felt there's something going on beyond what I can control.
Yeah, that's so good to hear. I mean, it's not good, but it's good to hear because there's so many women out there who are do feel like they're doing everything, you know? I kind of feel a little bit lucky because I feel like I've addressed so much in my past with metals and things like that, that I know exactly when I'm doing something wrong and it shows up pretty quickly in my body and I know what it is. Whereas when I was younger, the mysteries in my body were just too much, like the metals. Like that, I was having the most bizarre and mysterious things happening. And now it's pretty much like, you know, A causes B, et cetera. So, but I'm glad you brought up hysterectomies because that's really why I wanted to have you on today. Because we briefly talked about it in my last episode. And my one of my moderators in the group, Jennifer, we were talking about like how that comes up all the time, and that isn't enough discussed about hysterectomies and a lot of what is around it. So there's so much from should I get it? Why should I get it? All these different things. But let's just start with this first question comes from Sharon, actually. Why are they necessary? She says, I see so many women in the group who say they couldn't handle the pain or the bleeding, and that's why they got one. So let's just start there because I know you have so much with surgery and hysterectomies. Tell me a little bit about your perspective on this.
Yes, first of all, it's not a small surgery. Okay, we are cutting off major vessels to a major organ that allows us human women to have babies, right? So it's a big organ. It's an important organ. You can look at it from the chakras and energy level, and it represents fertility and it represents your womanhood. So when you cut that out, there's changes. There's studies where women after hysterectomy have actually higher increased incidence of depression. They feel like they're missing something that was a vital part of them. So something to bring up that as surgeon, I never discussed with people, but one that I learned later on. But let me tell you quickly about the surgical part of it. When we go and remove the uterus, we have to remove the vessels that connect the uterus with the ovaries. They're called utero-ovarian vessels. And we also have to remove the vessels that just give blood flow to the uterus, which are the uterine vessels. By disconnecting those utero-ovarian vessels, you're decreasing blood flow to the ovaries suddenly from overnight by 40% up to 50%. So now the ovaries are only getting their blood flow from the ovarian vessels, no longer from the utero-ovarian vessels. And so there are studies that show that women who get hysterectomy, they undergo menopause earlier, a few years. And they can also have hot flashes and hormonal changes that they experience afterwards because it
Okay.
does impact ovarian function.
Well, before we move forward with that, let's go ahead and throw in tubal ligation while we're at it. So I would imagine, yeah,
That's a
huge.
good point. That's a good point. Tubal ligation is when you tie the tubes. The tubes are not connected to the ovaries, so they do not impact the ovarian blood flow.
Okay.
But what we are nowadays doing is we have found that by removing the tubes, it you can decrease a certain incidence of a certain type of ovarian cancer. So a lot of times they don't tie them anymore. They actually just remove the tubes. There is some studies showing maybe that impacts a little bit the blood flow as well to the ovaries, but not as significantly as a hysterectomy would.
Okay.
So if someone were to undergo just that, it's definitely not the same impact as a hysterectomy.
But we definitely see, I mean, there was a huge discussion in the group today and yesterday about all the women who regret it because when they had their tubal ligation, their hormones just went south and it was just a huge problem.
Because I think it goes beyond just the simple blood flow, which is impacted, but also the lymphatics and how things communicate with each other that we cannot measure. Like there's also the frequencies and the, you know what I mean? It
Yeah.
goes beyond things that we can objectively always measure, or we haven't found tools to measure yet. So I 100% believe that women can experience that. And then with tubal ligation, let's not forget there's different methods to do it. And some of the older methods were clipping it with metals. You're putting a foreign body that can completely change the interference of these organs, and it can create an immune reaction. We never look at it that way, but those coils or the metal clips can cause problems. There was different coils that we used through the vaginal approach, where we would put them inside the tubes. This was called Esure, and it was taken off the market because a lot of women develop pain and issues with that. But the other ones we never took off the market, but I don't think a lot of people do them anymore. But yes, every time we mess with anything in the body, we are changing also the flow of the lymphatics, the energy flow, the frequency that these organs have with each other. I wish I had a way to measure that, almost with like an EMF meter that we have for EMF. I wish you could measure the energy and frequency. And maybe I'm very in tune with that today because I had craniosacral massage for the first time in my life, and she was describing to me fascia. And she said, fascia encompasses more than just muscles. She said, we have fascia incorporating every organ, and we have fascia actually encapsulating even fat cells. So anything you mess with, like you do liposuction, you can actually disrupt that fascia. So if I could measure people's energy flow, I'm sure we cause some scarring that disrupts that energy flow. But that's just my theory. I haven't read that anywhere. But when
Yeah, I mean,
you said that, I was like, that could impact that, you know?
absolutely. Yeah, I love this talk because it goes along with the lymph drainage and lymphatic flow and yeah, the fascia and the nerves. I mean, this is really probably one of the most overlooked areas of health care and self-care is this area.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we know that disrupts it. So go back to you were saying about removing the tubes, but then hysterectomies in general, just have at
Yes. She was asking, should we get it? Well, just know that if you're getting a hysterectomy, the most common reasons in a GYN practice are when someone has extremely big fibroids that cannot be otherwise, you know, taken care of, or they have endometriosis is a common cause for women to get it, or adenomyosis. And I'll explain that in layman terms a little bit. But those are very common reasons why someone gets a hysterectomy. But just know that all those three diseases are very much affected by an estrogen progesterone imbalance, right? So a lot of the times, by correcting that, you could help women maybe balance things out and help with heavy periods without having to undergo a hysterectomy to a certain degree. Because if your thyroids, I've done so many thyroid surgeries, and if the thyroids are coming up to your sternum, you cannot breathe. I have tried but micronized bioidentical progesterone in high doses for women, and I have not had success above a certain point because they have grown so much. So that could be one reason why women would need it, and it would certainly make their bleeding and their pain better. There's no question. Endometriosis is when the lining of the uterus is kind of outside of the uterus and it causes inflammation. Part of that treatment is when they do hysterectomy sometimes for women who keep continuing having problems. The problem is endometriosis grows outside the uterus. So even if you remove the uterus, you can absolutely continue to have problems because estrogen will continue to stimulate those endometrial cells inside the belly, outside of the uterus. You still have the problem, even if the uterus is gone. So that is like one of those cases where I would say you definitely want to get a second opinion and definitely want to think about how bad is your endometriosis. Is there any other alternatives? And you have to address the underlying hormone balance, because if you don't, it's going to come back even outside of the uterus, right? And then adenomyosis is almost like endometriosis, but in the uterine wall. So it's almost like the uterine wall is sick. Like it gets super inflamed every time you have a period. It swells up, has abnormal blood flow, lots of abnormal cytokines, inflammatory response. And those women suffer a lot. They always feel like they're several months pregnant on their period. Heavy flow, very heavy flow. Now, one thing that women should know is that women with adenomyosis and endometriosis have been shown to have disrupted progesterone receptors. So they don't respond to progesterone like a healthy woman. So you have to give them much higher doses to achieve similar results. I didn't know
Interesting.
that. Yeah.
Because, my mother, she had fibroids, but the biggest reason that they told her she should have a hysterectomy was because of her migraines. She was debilitated like for, 10 days at a time. It would start with, having to be like locked up in her bedroom with the shades down and just asleep on drugs for several days. And then it would carry on for several more days where she could still function, but it was still pretty bad. And it was so ongoing and so debilitating that the doctor said, let's just take your uterus. And so she did. And she, to this day, and sometimes despite me, says she wouldn't change a thing. She would, if she could go back, she would have done it sooner. And she was so happy with it. But then, they put her on Premarin and nothing else. And thank the Lord that she does not have cancer of any sort. She's in her late 70s now. But I think that what she does have and she's dealing with that she does not connect with hormone related issues or with her hysterectomy is diabetes and severe, so just these things I see her going through. She still has hot flashes. She still has bone loss. She still has all these things. And she won't listen to me when I say, well, it started when, like it started so long ago, like
Yes,
you were saying about,
absolutely.
dealing with the FSH back when you're much
Yeah.
younger and not waiting
Yes.
until you're waiting for the other signs when you're already in menopause or perimenopause.
Yes. Yeah. A few points on that. I don't think anybody should get a hysterectomy for migraines and should try to balance hormones and nutrients first, because it definitely has to do with that. Hormonal migraine has to do with the decrease and fall of progesterone and estrogen right before your period. And one of the tricks is to get sublingual rapid dissolving progesterone that you then can do multiple times a day. It doesn't make you tired like capsules because it bypasses the liver and it can break migraines. So it can break menstrual migraines and help with that. So that's a really good tip for women to know. Found out because there was an ER doctor that he does a hormone course. His name is Dr. Neil Rosier. And he found out that if he gave women with menstrual migraines IM progesterone, he could break their migraines. So then for
Interesting.
home, for them not to go to the emergency room, what you could do was the sublingual progesterone can be very helpful.
I had really good luck with mega dosing topical cream,
Yeah.
but I bet you the oral would have been a much easier route because the sublingual, because I was doing 3% and I was mega dosing 800 milligrams. You can imagine how much cream that is in a
Yeah.
day.
And
It's huge.
it makes a lot of sense because with the cream, you're having a depot effect. So it has to bypass the skin. And then also, it basically works by having a depot effect and being taken up by fat cells and then slowly released. So I love transdermal progesterone for so many reasons. But when you have an acute migraine, it's not the most rapid active. And I don't like progesterone capsules either because it has to go through the liver and then it makes you tired. But it's the beginning of your day. You want to function. So you do the sublingual and you do the sublingual, you're bypassing the liver. It works within 30 minutes and you break your migraine that way. So
Nice.
I would never recommend any woman to get hysterectomy for migraines. But what is also interesting, what you mentioned is she was placed on Premarin, which we both know is probably the worst type of estrogen to ever do because it's not bioidentical. It's from pregnant horses, horse urine. And so, but she was never placed on progesterone. Can you
Never.
guess why I'm not a fan of that? I mean, what was she missing out? I mean, she was missing out on a ton, right? The
Oh,
positive
so much.
effects of progesterone.
All right. Well, after you get a hysterectomy, when one or both of the ovaries are left, are they still producing some hormones and in like a cyclical manner, like you would have your regular cycle.
Yes, they would. And in fact, some women still feel their ovulation pain. They can tell which ovaries are ovulating, and they'll still have the PMS. So they can literally tell where they are in their cycle from PMS symptoms if they're very in tune with their bodies. But what, and then, as the ovarian function goes down, they would feel more the hot flashes and all that. But yes, absolutely, the ovaries can continue to function.
Okay. One of the questions here someone was asking mentioned the UK. Have you noticed that there is this really big push from the NHS towards estrogen only and even Marina Coil?
The NHS, unfortunately, is a terrible example of who anybody should listen to, but it's why I am against socialized healthcare, because the decisions are
Yes.
made based on money. It's like you can see it with the Kaiser insurance system in California. When you work for Kaiser as a doctor, you cannot allow to give women everything they want or give them all the options they have. You have to go based on protocols. So the NHS is part of a socialized healthcare system that's broke. The NHS
Yeah.
has been broke for years. So I wouldn't be surprised if that decision had been made based on financial reasons. So they're thinking, okay, micronized progesterone, we don't want to cover that for insurance, like the promethium in our country.
Yeah.
So maybe, no, I'm serious. I would not be surprised if their recommendation was based on some sort of calculation of what makes most sense financially, what they can cover for women.
Yeah.
Because micronized progesterone might be backlogged, or it might be hard to get, or it might be more expensive. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But beyond that cynical, viewpoint, what else could be? I see a lot of people within the US push for the IUD, and the NAMS providers, the so-called NAMS menopause providers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do not like NAMS at all. I do not think they get it right. I mean, there are people within NAMS, they call themselves menopause experts, and then they, or perimenopause experts, and they give the birth control to women in perimenopause. I'm like, of all the options we have, you think birth control is the best option for women?
Yeah, I mean, I saw a video of a woman from the NHS, a medical doctor, a gynecologist, and it was a purposely filmed video that they marketed that I saw coming on my feed, and I got so many questions about this. And it was a doctor putting a almost perimenopausal woman on the Marina Coil, and why it was ideal for her. And I just thought, gosh, that is so backwards and so missing so much information there.
It is. I think the reason is it's easier for doctors to deal with those heavy periods and irregular periods and just put the Mirena in. And then even in menopause, women get put on a Mirena when they're on estrogen sometimes because they're at higher risk for uterine cancer. And then the doctors don't want to deal with that, that having to check on them every time they start having spotting again or irregular bleeding in menopause. And so it's easier to do a Mirena because it gives them some sort of like a safety, right? That there is a progestin in the uterine lining. And then their argument is this is a localized therapy. But we know that synthetic progestin has systemic effects. There was an MRI study from Germany a few years back. And they saw that the breast inflammation and density increased with the IUD. So if it had just localized effects, how would those breast inflammation markers go out? Or how would it look different on an MRI? And I know it from women describing to me systemic effects. They feel more depressed, or they have more breast tenderness, or there's a lot of progestin effect from the IUD. Having said that, I'm just explaining it from the medical perspective. It makes it easier to deal with the bleeding that women can experience when they are on estrogen. It makes it easier for the doctors. But to me, it's not the most natural approach because it's not bioidentical progesterone. And we know from the Women's Health Initiative study that the only group that had increased risk for breast cancer was the group with the synthetic progestin, right?
Right.
So now, if I recommend a birth control pill that has synthetic progestin or an IUD that has synthetic progestin, I'm potentially increasing the risk of breast cancer.
Yeah.
But I don't have that with the micronized bioidentical progesterone. In fact, the bioidentical progesterone has effects that the synthetic progestin never will have. Namely, it suppresses, so it helps with immune system function. So it suppresses the immune system in a good way. So a lot of autoimmune diseases are improved with bioidentical progesterone. It has positive effects on the tumor suppressor gene P53. So it actually decreases the risk of breast cancer and ovarian cancer. You do not get that with synthetic progestins. Right? It actually also improves osteoblast function, which is the, bone forming cells in the bones. So it improves that function. So it improves bone health. You also have the improved brain function because the bioidentical progesterone, not the synthetic progestin, can help the myelin sheath of the nerves, and it can also stimulate nerve growth. All these positive effects, you do not get that from a Mirena. You do not get that from a norethindrone. You do not get that from the birth control pill, right? So it makes a difference what you put a woman on. And then beyond that, I mean, what I love also is that there is some data that bioidentical progesterone improves lactobacillus contact in the gut, so it can improve the gut microbiome. Yes, I found that one study. I was like, that's amazing. Because what we usually always associate it with is that it can slow down the GI motility. And that is true because progesterone relaxes muscle, smooth muscle. So it can slow down in women who are more constipated, can make it a little bit worse, but it can have positive impact on the gut microbiome. And I was
So
like, oh,
interesting. I mean,
yeah.
there it's so varied because in the group, I see women who complain about it making them have like faster motility in a bad way, like maybe getting a little runny stool. And then some women are like, well, I get more bloated. And I just did an article about that because Kiran Krishnan, the microbiologist, was talking about how that could potentially stimulate estrogen, and then estrogen gets dumped into the bowel, and that process happens, and how that can not just when you supplement progesterone, but also when you're around your period or when you're having high estrogen spikes or estrogen dominance, how that can make you bloated and slow, do all kinds of things to your bowel movements and to your digestion.
Yes. And the synthetic progestins definitely make women more bloated because they have more of the cortisol-like effect. But excess bioidentical progesterone can have that effect to excess because some of it can be converted into
Into
cortisol. But
cortisol.
that's only if it's more than you need, than your body needs. And so then it can create that bloating and water retention. But you get that a lot more from the synthetic progestins. And then the synthetic progestins have androgenic effect, but not in a good way. Like they push your own natural testosterone away from its function. So they can decrease libido and all that positive testosterone effect. But then they have the androgenic effect, and then it can lead to hair growth in the face or hair thinning. Like I have women on the Mirena IUD tell me, Doc, my hair is thinning. And they're surprised that I say, yeah, it could. And they're so prepared for a GYN to dismiss them and gaslight them that when I say, yep, yeah, you're right. It's that synthetic
But it
progestin. It
does.
can cause that. And so I'm like, you want it out? You're like, yeah, absolutely. So it's just, because I see a lot of patients who get it placed elsewhere. The practice where I am, we don't do that right now because we're a cash practice and they're a concierge GYN practice, but I could remove it for them if they wanted it out. And I thought the breast, I think it, that study with the breast MRI is super interesting. That it creates more inflammation in the breast. So it's not protective of the breast like progesterone is, but bioidentical progesterone is protective of the breast. I mean, you and I use it for dense breasts and fibrocystic breast disease and all that, right? So I thought that was very interesting too.
Well, that just made me think of something slightly off topic, but very interesting, is that I have a little Shih Tzu mix, and she and I didn't fix her. And I've had so many dogs, and I've used progesterone on most of them. But this one, she didn't get fixed, and they warned me. They said, if you're not going to fix her, she's her chances of breast cancer are very, 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 I mean, like really high.
Okay.
And that's troublesome for sure. So I noticed that she actually started getting, she's already six now, and she started getting this one of her teats, one of her little nipples was totally different than the other ones and kind of inverted, and it would get dirty. And when she was younger, now it got really swollen. This was a couple of weeks ago, really swollen. And then when I tried to clean it out, clean up the tissue, the skin would just start to bleed. There was definitely some like low-grade infection, inflammation, and it was like if I was anyone else, I probably would have taken her to the vet. But what did I do? I put progesterone on it. I put Luna oil on it, and I just kept doing it twice a day, and then I put some on her nose as well. And within 3 days, it was completely normal looking again. That the impact it has on breast tissue is so positive and so rapid. And I had a similar situation with some inflammation under my right armpit. I mentioned this to my group before. And same thing, just up my dosage of progesterone, and it just seemed like that tissue loves progesterone. It's really cool.
Super interesting. And I don't know if you knew that, but often when we give transdermal progesterone, we can't really measure its effect in the serum. And that's because they found out that even better than urine and serum for that, it's because it's in the lymphatics. So part of the reason it works here maybe is because it's carried through the lymphatics mostly anyways. So anything with
Oh.
lymph nodes might be affected more. But that's the preferred transportation method for progesterone. That's why we can measure it as well in the serum. And
Interesting. Did you know that Mark Newman, who owns Precision Analytical, he just came out with this big announcement about the Dutch, and he basically said, I had Carol Peterson on my show talking about this because, he said that we cannot measure because we cannot measure progesterone supplementation in dried urine, in urine, you should not take it because it's not protecting the uterus. And of course, everybody just went bonkers. The everyone who was like, see, I told you so. And then people like me who are like, what are you talking about? I used it to shrink cysts in my uterus. No, that is completely incorrect. So I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier, which is depends on your receptors. It depends on how you absorb it, where you apply it, how often, the strength, all of these variables that matter, because it certainly did protect my uterus for years. It saved me from a hysterectomy. As I mentioned, my mom, my sister, I mean, they're so quick to say, look, it's genetic for you. Just get it out. Let's get it out. And I'm like, you are smoking crack. I'm not taking my uterus out. And that's exactly what happened. I just used, and all I had at the time was transdermal progesterone. All I had was access to transdermal. It was wonderful for me. So I just think it's, and yeah, maybe it's not showing up in my dried urine or even 24-hour urine, but that what does that mean? Carol said, Dr. Carol Peterson said, yeah, well, lucky if anything shows up, I mean, in your blood, you can't rely on the labs to really show you what's going on necessarily. What do you
I
think?
love Carol. She's one of my favorite people.
I know.
I gotta listen to that one. Yeah, I think because with the transdermal, specifically with the lymphatic transportation, there's no way to measure that. There were some studies that looked at transdermal and then endometrial lining, and they said that it didn't significantly make it thinner. But I myself have seen the effects of transdermal progesterone on. So it's a very, but as doctors, we have to always be careful because if the official recommendation is oral progesterone, then if something, God forbid, happened to someone and they went back and they saw that I never, gave them that, they could come after my license, but they could come after my license for such a multitude of things. That doesn't always mean that's something that I agree with. It has to do with what all these big societies describe as standard of care. And as of now, they're describing the oral progesterone as standard of care if you're on estrogen. It's true. It's true. But do I agree with that? I agree more with what you said. There's a very, very delicate balance to always, and you could probably give women ultrasounds to do just to keep an eye and then obviously clinically monitor people. But that goes back to why a lot of doctors, they don't want to deal with that. So they put an IUD in there. They're like, I don't want to deal with that. Let's just put an IUD in there.
Yeah,
That way,
let's do what they
protected
think is the
her, you know?
safest thing. Yeah, it comes down
Yeah.
to that litigious thing as well, like, is someone going to sue me? I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine.
Oh,
So let's see. We talked about unopposed estrogen. So when a woman has a hysterectomy, let's say she, so I know that you believe this as well, that if a woman is suffering so much and she hasn't been able to find the right care because she can't afford a functional practitioner or she what for whatever reason, and she just makes a decision, I can't take this anymore, I'm going to do it, that she should never feel like less of a woman or upset because, like looked down upon because of that decision. There's so many things she can do. And I always say to them, look, once you make up your mind, let's just move forward. Let's not judge your decision. Let's move forward and say, now what can we do now that you are free from that misery to make sure it doesn't manifest in other ways, like you said before. Yeah, you can remove the uterus, but that doesn't mean endometriosis isn't going to keep growing, or that that excess estrogen that was growing things in your ovaries or whatever, that it's not going to grow things elsewhere. So, what is the most important thing a woman can begin to do once she's had her hysterectomy?
It's a great question. First of all, I give you 100%. I never make anybody feel guilty about their decisions. And sometimes that's the best decision for them at that point. And I have had women hug me in tears after I did their, or after I did her hysterectomies, you know. They said it changed their lives and they're able to work out again and they're able to be active because they're not bleeding at every second of the day. So absolutely, never feel judged, women. I just don't want everyone to think that that's the only option in some cases, but in other cases, it might be the only option for them. And it's always good to know you can get a second opinion. And that's one thing I wanted to say. This is not because it brings me business or anything, but sometimes I just love to be a second opinion for people. So if you have all your paperwork and your OBGYN said you need a hysterectomy and you just want someone like me to look at that, I offer that. Just it's a 30-minute visit. I just a one-time thing. I look over everything and I'll
How
tell you the price.
nice.
So I just want women to know they have that option available if they're feeling really stuck. Okay, but beyond that, how can you optimize? Just know that because you had a hysterectomy doesn't mean you don't need progesterone, and that progesterone has a lot of beneficial effects for you. It reduces anxiety, it reduces depression, it helps your sleep, it helps your bones, it helps your cardiovascular system, it works on the endothelium, it makes your vasodilation better. That means your blood pressure will be less prone to increase your smooth muscle function. So, meaning that's why the vessels are less rigid with progesterone. It's a good thing. It's a really good thing. It helps your bones, as I said, it helps your brain. So just because you had a hysterectomy doesn't mean you don't need progesterone. What else you should obviously, and obviously the breast protection, because if they just put you on estrogen, you get the stimulation, but you don't have the protective effect of the progesterone. That again is a downside for your breast health. So just for those reasons alone, ask for micronized bioidentical progesterone. And you can do it in a cyclical way, or you can do it and you can if you don't know when your cycles are because you had a hysterectomy, you can sync it with the lunar cycle. You know, you could do that because that's what we originally like sync our periods with. If we're completely aligned with that, often we have a lot of artificial light and everything interfering with that. But the lunar cycle, a lot of women are actually sync up with that. So you could sync it up with that, or you could listen to your PMS symptoms. Like if you get breast pain, that's mostly you're in the luteal phase. So you could adjust progesterone then. So you can cycle it. Because if you cycle it, there's a bigger beneficial effect on that tumor suppressor gene than the non-cycling way. But if you don't want to deal with that, you don't want to count or whatever, just take it daily. Still better than not being on progesterone at all. What else can you do? You definitely need to help your liver detoxification pathways and your gut health. And you and I are so aligned on that. You need to definitely, look at your methylation. You can do a Dutch test. You can look at your estrogen metabolites. You can look at your gut stool testing. Or without doing any of those tests, just focus on eating healthy, decreasing caffeine and alcohol if you can, doing castor oil packs, sauna. Methylated B vitamins can help with estrogen detoxification. You want to make sure you poop regularly because that helps with estrogen detoxification. You want to get your lymphatics growing, okay? Because the lymphatics move everything and the toxins also out of your body. You can do mineral balancing. So you can do a lot to just optimize your health in other ways that can have an effect on your hormones.
Okay. So here's the big question. So I know for a fact that a lot of women who've had hysterectomies have not had to take estrogen. And my guess is that they're still producing estrogen in their adrenals and in their adipose tissue. So women don't necessarily have to take estrogen, but how would you then decide if whether or not to take it? Shouldn't you check first?
Sure, you can check. Absolutely. I'm never against testing and then automatically start them. Only they do that only when the ovaries are removed as part of the hysterectomy. So I've never seen patients automatically started on estrogen if the ovaries were remained in place, because the ovaries will continue to produce estrogen even
Okay.
after hysterectomy.
So we're talking
So
about a full hysterectomy. That's when they would most likely recommend for
yeah,
sure.
so a total or full hysterectomy is actually just really refers to the uterus, but a lot of women call that like that, and they mean the ovaries are removed, but that's actually a different
Oh.
word. Yeah, that would actually be called total hysterectomy and bilateral salpingo oophorectomy. That only refers to the ovaries being removed.
What? I
Yeah,
just learned something
but
new.
it's a
That's amazing.
mouthful. It's a mouthful. I don't think anybody calls it that, like in
Just
layman's.
total with ovaries.
Yeah,
That's
total
probably
ovaries. I think that would be a good way to put that. Yes.
okay.
So yes, if you had total with ovaries, I think it's a good way. It's a good idea to check and monitor symptoms and test people, you know. But then again, you saw yourself, there's such a difference between tissue levels and serum levels. And then it comes down to, you can measure your FSH as well, because that will tell you what the feedback to the brain is. And then also just go clinical symptoms. Like if someone is having severe hot flashes, night sweats, it is a sign of like a stark. So when we feel those things, by the way, mostly is when there is a stark change, when the levels change. That's why we feel a lot of things right before the period, or we feel a lot of things right after we have a baby, because the levels change so abruptly. So with a surgical menopause, which means the ovaries are removed, women will overnight feel a stark decline, because the ovaries are the biggest producers of estrogen for them, right? More than the adrenals and the fat tissue. So when that's gone, they're going to feel that stark decline. So that's when they will mostly have the symptoms. And then over time, that can balance itself out, because the body reacts mostly to changes, not to static levels,
Yeah,
right?
because I mean, there's certainly a lot of women who go into menopause and from one day to the next. And they actually have a decent estrogen levels, or maybe the estrogen went into tissues and progesterone was low. I've seen a lot of women, including myself, correct hot flashes with progesterone. So it does seem it's more like a change thing. Also with stress. Stress is crazy, like you mentioned. It's
Crazy.
just like literally, your reaction to stressful things, what that does to your hormones, as opposed to like maybe a man. With a woman, like, gosh, you can have like a stressful event happen, and then you can have hot flashes the whole next day after that event, and not even put that together. It's so the change, the dramatic changes, like you said,
Yes,
something to look out for.
absolutely. And having said that, there's so many things I still don't understand. Like last time I had this patient, and she said she can't do anything. She doesn't tolerate progesterone. It causes anxiety. She doesn't tolerate estrogen. She doesn't tolerate thyroid. Anything causes extreme anxiety and popping. And then I think there is methylation issues that I would have to genetically test her for. And
Yeah.
who knows what else is playing a role. Like there's so many sometimes difficult cases where we have to figure out some way around it. Like they
Yeah.
respond in an abnormal way to anything, anything. She said also she's become hypersensitive to almost everything else too. And obviously, I always become more concerned about heavy metals, mold, than something underlying for this kind of cases. But I definitely don't deny that there are, all of us are different in the way our enzymes work, our genetics, and how that can also impact how we metabolize hormones as well.
Yeah. I mean, I feel so bad because I really feel like this is more and more common, when, like I said, when I started in this space, almost 10 years ago, the hormone space, and then the gut health space was an additional, 7 years or something, was definitely like not as much of this that I was kind of that way where I reacted to everything, but I was a weirdo. Like I didn't know anyone like me.
You were an outlier, yeah, but
Yeah, I
that's
was like,
common.
yeah. And then now, oh my goodness, like so many women are just, they take a supplement and have the complete opposite reaction than they should. I mean, it is, and all I can think is that our bodies are in such a state of a fight or flight. We have severe cortisol dysregulation. And then you add to that your like nervous system stuff. You're like you were talking about, like almost on a spiritual level, like what's going on with your body and your somatic nervous system. You put those to that dysregulation together, and I mean, you're like a walking open wound. You're just everything is just triggering you in every possible way. And I see it so much. It's so sad.
I for her, I'm recommending micronutrient testing, but also the HTMA, because one of the theories is that through ionic mimicry, heavy metals go and block receptors in the body, so nothing else can dock. And so if you give them that, whatever it is that you gave them, whatever hormone or whatever, they're going to overreact to that because they cannot even dock to the receptor and have their function. And
Wow.
it causes more dysregulation. And by creating and clearing up those heavy metals from those receptors, that oversaturation, you can help them react in a more normal way. But beyond that, you can also have cases where mold has completely caused such a leaky gut that anything they orally take in, they're just going to have a weird reaction to that because it is inflammation. So there could be so many underlying things. So I like to always keep my mind open to toxins and other environmental things. And then obviously methylation activity could be important too, you know?
Yeah, because that epigenetic factor, right? We can have all of these different SNPs that that hinder us from
Yes.
absorbing certain vitamins or making certain
Yes.
nutrients, and that epigenetic factor can activate those SNPs where normally you might not even have any issues with them. Like I know people because during COVID, who prior to COVID they were completely normal people, like health-wise they were totally fine, and then they went through COVID, had COVID, and then had the vaccine, and now their body reacts in such vastly different ways that they just triggered or activated SNPs in their body, genetic mutations that
Absolutely.
were not active before. They have them, but they weren't active. And so now they're all of a sudden they're, having these hypersensitivities to things. It's
And
incredible.
it can cause dysautonomia and autonomic nervous dysregulation, as you mentioned earlier. And COVID has been shown to cause that too. So they have that adrenaline, cortisol, everything is out of whack. You're absolutely right. And then it reactivates any type of viral infection you had in the past because COVID almost itself works like a mediator for all those bad things to come up again. So Epstein-Barr reactivates, herpes viruses reactivate. So a lot of people feel like they're overflooded. Their immune system is overflooded with everything.
So let's talk about really quick. I know I've had you on for, can you believe it's almost an hour already? But
Always like that with you.
I wanted to ask you, here we are. I just had asked the group if they had questions, so I want to make sure I don't skip any. I think you covered quite a bit. But so second opinion is a big deal. Like get a second opinion. Be prepared to ask for testing afterwards, that you don't just want to jump on any kind of hormones because you might not necessarily need them. Organ removal rather than on, yeah, that's a bunch of people said, why is there such a disparity between, doctors saying you don't need progesterone, you don't have hysterectomy, it's fine. Look, you don't need your well, you kind of already answered this though, because it's easier. And because it's recommended by the establishment, it's also safer for them.
Yes.
Okay. So you
Correct.
yeah.
100%.
Let's see. Some of these I haven't even read. Praise the Lord. Thank you. Can't wait. I'm fighting to avoid one, but my uterus is screaming out that it wants one. Oh, this is Vanessa.
Oh.
Adenomyosis and fibroid uterus with suspected endometriosis around the bowel. Meditation and breathing helps the pain, but I need to be able to live again. Doing progesterone and castor packs, red light therapy,
Yes.
acupuncture, the list is so long.
Oh.
I'm so scared my nervous system won't be able to handle the trauma after having a long, difficult recovery after nephrectomy. I'm afraid the remaining organs will get lost, not work. A few months ago, I was so scared I canceled it because I was afraid the surgery would break my body. Now I have times, despite breathing and taking care of my body, that the uterus gets so angry, I feel it screaming at me like an adolescent. A few weeks ago, I was at acupuncture and it started in, and I was tempted to reach in and pull it out myself.
Oh.
When is it time to listen to your body? How
Oh.
to really know? Aw,
What is her name? What's her name?
Vanessa. Vanessa.
Vanessa. Listen, first of all, Vanessa, never feel guilty about making a decision about something that you feel your body's telling you might feel you better. You are a complicated case, Vanessa. You have fibroids, you have adenomyosis, and you have endometriosis. That is very difficult to control without any kind of other help. You have already seems like optimized everything. You are doing the castor oil, you're doing the red light, you are doing progesterone. If you're still not getting relief, the surgery might help you. Here are a few things I would like to recommend to you to make your recovery better. So first of all, make sure your surgeon is a GYN surgeon specialized in surgery, not a baby deliverer anymore. The way I was trained for endometriosis, I did endometriosis surgery and fibroid surgery for 2 years only, just that. No babies, nothing else. We had a fellowship in that. You can find a trained endometriosis surgeon, and there are very good ones in this country. And if you need a name, if I know where you live, I will help you. Second of all, you can do things to improve preoperative and postoperative outcomes. And I learned that from functional medicine, not in residency when I should have needed that. First, you want to optimize your collagen intake and vitamin C intake. You can do that with oral vitamin C and collagen powder. You want to optimize your protein. You can drink bone broth as much as you can. It will help your tissue to build up resilience so it recovers better. I also recommend that in a post-operative recovery, vitamin C and collagen bone broth, very helpful. Okay. In addition to that, you want to calm down the nervous system. Your adrenaline overactivity, bioidentical progesterone will help. Other natural things like optimizing your sleep, some herbals can help with that. If you're excess cortisol at bedtime, you can help phosphatidylserine or ashwagandha. Very helpful to calm you down so you don't go into surgery with so much fear and anxiety. And if you have to do some body work, some tissue trauma release work, I call it somatic therapy. There's tapping, there's other somatic therapy that actually really helps you so that you don't go into surgery thinking someone is traumatizing you because you have PTSD from your previous surgery. So I would recommend you start that now and you continue that after the surgery. That's how I would talk to her if she was in a consult with me. And then the next thing is, so you optimize your diet, you optimize your vitamin C collagen intake, you work on your nervous system, on your sleep, and on trauma. And then beyond that, you really seek yourself the best endometriosis surgeon out there because if you have it on your bowel, they better be prepared to have a colorectal surgeon there that can shave it off so your bowel functions very well afterwards. And I will tell you, I have done these surgeries and I've seen those surgeries, and women can recover very well and do very well afterwards. Okay. So, whatever you need to strengthen your mind also to go into that with the most positive outlook. Okay. Because one thing we should know, and Kitty, I thought I mentioned that quickly, but it's very hard to treat endometriosis with progesterone alone because they have a progesterone receptor dysfunction. You almost need like really high doses. I have endometriosis patients, I give them 600 milligrams. I mean, it's so high because the receptors don't work, and progesterone actually calms down the endocannabinoid receptors. It stimulates the endocannabinoid receptors that affect the immune cells that are implicated in endometriosis. So there's a whole dysfunction there. And so to support that just with like regular doses of progesterone is going to be very hard, you know? So what I would recommend to her as well, Vanessa, when you get your surgery, your journey is not done. You can still benefit from bioidentical progesterone afterwards. That's what I would add to that.
And all of that other stuff she's doing, continue
And
to do
all of
that
that,
because,
continue to do that, continue the castor oil pack, the red light. It actually helps wound healing. The red light, there are studies, it helps wound healing. And then one more thing. I'm so glad I can think of everything right now. That's another thing I would tell you in a consult is
is that
find
cranial
yourself.
sacral work you had?
Yes, find yourself maybe a visceral manipulation physical therapist that can help with scar tissue movement so you don't form too much scar tissue after the surgery. And you can start that pretty quickly on after surgery. It's called visceral manipulation. And then if you can get craniosacral work as well, it will move the lymphatics and the soft tissue and the fascia along. And so that your scar formation is impacted in a positive way.
Okay,
Okay. So
okay.
I would tell her all of that and not feel bad about having to undergo surgery.
That was so beautiful. I'm going to leave you this one last question and we'll wrap it up. It's probably a big one though. And that's so you've had a hysterectomy. Now, what are you going to do about sex?
You know, that's a really good question. There was a French study where they showed that if you remove the cervix, it can impact orgasm for women who are able to have G spot orgasms. There is the O spot orgasm and the G spot. And the G spot is very far back in the vagina, and it's related to the nerve fibers that innervate the uterus and the cervix. So if you have a total hysterectomy and the cervix is removed, that could impact that, but only for the women who has that kind of orgasm to begin with. Not every woman does. Like, I personally don't know what that feels like. I only know clitoral orgasms, right? So, like, for example, so that has been shown. That doesn't mean you cannot enjoy sex afterwards. If you're someone who was mainly a clitoral orgasm woman, really, the cervix being there or not is not going to make a big difference for you. Okay. In
Okay.
fact, the fact that you're not going to bleed every time after intercourse, the fact that you're not going to have cramping every time after intercourse because your uterus is not large with like fibroids in there, it might actually make sex better for you. That's how I would go about it. But it's an interesting conversation. And women can ask for the cervix to be left if they wanted to. There is some data that shows less risk of prolapse of the vagina afterwards. And for those women who are very sensitive to that innervation of the cervix, they like that sensation with deep penetration. It does make sex still more pleasurable for them.
That is so interesting. I had not thought about a
Yeah.
prolapse because that definitely is something that women have to deal, some women end up dealing with. So if they leave the cervix, they're less likely to have
Because
prolapse.
the attachments of the cervix are not disrupted. The uterus has to be disconnected at different levels when we do a hysterectomy. And the last attachment of the cervix, if you leave the cervix in, it allows it to still be remaining in place. That doesn't mean you're not going to develop a prolapse later on, anyways, but it will make it a little bit less likely in the studies they showed.
Wow. Oh my goodness. You just like triggered an entirely new podcast that we can talk about next time.
But definitely sex is possible after a hysterectomy. Nothing to worry about. There is other ways we can optimize sexual health for women. This is one of the things I love in the concierge practice that I'm in now because we very much focus on that. We do stimulation of the clitoris with platelet-rich plasma. We can help with radio frequency, bring more blood flow to the vagina so they can actually feel their partner better. Very like gentle ways to optimize their sexual
Wait,
health.
where are you?
I'm in Clearwater, Florida.
Oh, you are? How did I not know that? Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's really interesting. You know, I came out with this new Luna product, Ona's product called L it's a 5% oil. Before we had the 10%, now we have a 5% oil, and I added a little bit of spearmint to it. And it's kind of, and you know, so I'm like thinking because the vitamin E to me is really gross. Like it just tastes, it's not that yummy at all. But this makes it like really tolerable. But then, you know, a lot of women put it on vaginally or topically. And I'm like, so I'm like, well, if it's too tingly, I don't want to recommend that people use it. But I was like, oh, hey, this is kind of nice. I kind of like the tingles.
Yes, it improves blood flow and the sensation down there.
Nice. Well, that's good to know. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
I love her. I love her. I love her. I wish that I had known about her 10 years ago when I was really going through it. She would have been exactly the person that I would have wanted to see for my hormonal stuff. And it's so cool when a doctor can be like, hey, I'm going through some stuff too. You know, I mentioned it in the beginning of the podcast. Like there's a level of personable ability that is just so attractive when a doctor can say to you, yeah, I have that too, or I had that too, and this is what I did, you know, instead of like kind of looking at you like you're weird, you know. Anyway, please check her out. She mentions that she'll look over and give you a second opinion, look over your labs. Her information is in the show notes, and so is everything else that we talked about. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.